Have you ever tried to stop or change a habit or a pattern of behavior that you or someone else has? Oh my, there's some knowing laughs here. Well, there you go. There's some stories behind those laughs. In our Elevation Worship Service last month, we explored the idea of developing habits of faith. And also this last week, Reverend Darren McDonald, in his presentation at Elevation, helped us see a few ways of breaking out of those cycles that are offered us in the gospel, some of which we'll touch on today. But one of the examples he used was, it's much easier to tell a child, go stand over there, than to say, stop running. Because it's harder to stop an action, it's easier to substitute a different action. And that works for us as adults too, those of you who are trying to change eating habits or smoking habits. You know, that trigger that wants you to do that, oh, I'm feeling bored, so I'm gonna have a snack at my desk. Someone said, well, my new habit is when I'm feeling bored, I'll get up and take a walk up and down the steps. So it is harder to simply stop doing something than it is to say, instead of doing this, I will do this, to change that pattern. I remember an illustration I first heard used by Reverend Troy Perry, the founder of MCC, and I heard him use it in a sermon a couple of times. Yes, pastors do occasionally repeat themselves, as you have probably noticed. But he tells this great story. I'm sure it's, it may be a true story, but he tells a story about a man who was walking to work one day on the familiar path that he would always walk. And he fell into a deep hole that had appeared in the sidewalk. A sinkhole had happened in the sidewalk. So he was shocked and startled and hurt and scuffed up, and he clawed his way out and dusted himself off and made his way to work. Well, the next day, he was walking to work again, the same familiar path, and he fell into the hole again. Again, surprised that, oh my gosh, I fell into the hole that was in the sidewalk that I walked to work every day. Well, the next day, he said, okay, well, maybe if I ignore it, I won't fall into it. So he walked down the sidewalk, and surprise, surprise, he fell in the hole once again. The following day, he decided, well, I won't ignore it. Let me see if I can walk around it. Well, by that time, it had grown even larger, and as he tried to walk around it, he tripped and fell into the hole once again. The next day, when he walked to work, he decided, you know, I am going to take a different sidewalk to work rather than try to avoid that hole. Sometimes we need to learn to do something other than what we have always done before. That is kind of one of the definitions of insanity, doing the same thing over and over again and you expect to have a different outcome. Today's reading from the Gospel according to Matthew ends what is a short series on portions of the Sermon on the Mount. And although this reading at the end of the fifth chapter of Matthew doesn't take us to the conclusion of the whole sermon, it covers about three full chapters. In Matthew's Gospel, this is the first sermon that Jesus delivered, the Sermon on the Mount. And it is filled with some of those best known, those best loved, those inspiring, and I would add, often misunderstood sayings of Jesus. If you recall, it began with that series of unexpected blessings that we most often call the Beatitudes. And then it was followed by this strong encouragement for his followers to be the salt of the earth and the light of the world. And then it turns to this series of statements where Jesus reframes the commonly held wisdom that was inherited and known in his day, and he reframes it and makes it even harder and more demanding by insisting upon examining the motive of the heart rather than following the rule, which basically gets you nowhere. And this series of sayings begins, you have heard it said, common wisdom, but I say to you what it is Jesus demands. And he used those difficult examples of anger, of lust, of divorce. And today is a continuation of those sayings where he reframes what may even be more well-known, and I also believe even more misunderstood, sayings of Jesus. He begins by saying again, "You have heard it said," and then he offers a contrasting, even more demanding standard. "But I say to you," you've heard it said, "but I say to you." And he doesn't just speak in an abstract way. He gives concrete and exceedingly challenging examples of the kind of life that he was going to model and would be asking his followers to model. All of them about ways of relating to people, none of them about ritual observance, really, and all of them revealing the core principles of what it was going to look like to live in the reign of God, what the dominion of heaven that was being ushered in was going to look like, a vision of a new world for his followers, and a vision of a world that, let's face it, still looks pretty strange to us. Turn the other cheek, give your coat, go the second mile. It's peculiar to us because we do not yet see it fully lived, do we? We catch glimpses only. Today's first statement is probably the most familiar. "You have heard it said, an eye for an eye, a tooth for a tooth." Now, for the record, we need to realize there was no biblical command to take revenge, to take an eye for an eye or a tooth for a tooth, but the command that existed was actually a restriction on unchecked cycles of revenge. It's better for us to understand that eye for an eye, tooth for a tooth, as saying you only take an eye for an eye, you only take a tooth for a tooth. Still violent to us. But in that honor and shame society of the ancient Near East, even that rule was a step forward, a step out of unchecked revenge and retaliation, which we do often see over and again, not only in our world, but scripture. Because it's a problem that isn't just ancient. When we experience a hurt or an injury or offense, do we not sometimes also have the same impulse? We want to make that offending party hurt more because of my hurt. That even leads to the quip, "An eye for an eye and a tooth for a tooth leaves everyone blind and toothless." Everyone blind and toothless. It is a cycle of insanity that needs interruption, both then and now. Too often, I think, we hear this admonition of Jesus to turn the other cheek as a counsel to passivity in the face of abuse. And that interpretation is really quite inconsistent with the Jesus that we see, who was hardly passive. He was more than willing to call out and confront authorities. This was the same Jesus who overturned tables and drove the money changers out of the temple. It's a misinterpretation that Jesus taught his followers to be doormats. We miss the point that his original audience would have gotten, that he was teaching a practical way to interrupt a cycle of brokenness and violence and to change the world with that great interruption. Without doubt, Jesus modeled nonviolence, but over and again he confronted injustice, not passive acceptance, neither violent retaliation, but a third way, nonviolent resistance. Nonviolent resistance. When we hear in English the beginning of this, the language that Jesus uses, at least that we hear in English, when it says, "Do not resist," the Greek word that was used in that case is a Greek word that is most often used in warfare. The Greek word really was about armed combat, war resistance against something or someone. So the advice of Jesus is not to engage in armed violence or insurrection. But even still, if we know that little tidbit, the examples of nonviolent resistance are still lost if we don't know a little bit about Roman-occupied Palestine. And remember, the crowd that Jesus was mostly addressing, certainly in his first messages, were the working poor and the marginalized. Now, I have shared these examples before because I can no longer ever read them without recalling the brilliant work of Walter Wink and his book, Powers That Be, probably one of the best books written in the last century of theology. He did much of his theologizing when he was working in South Africa, a modern example of how nonviolent resistance can change the world. So this first admonition of Jesus, turn the other cheek. I need an adult volunteer to join me up here on the dais. Is there a grown-up that is willing to step on up here? Oh, he's tall, too. Wow, awesome. Awesome. So, we hear the admonition to turn the other cheek. Now, we have all seen, I promise I will not hurt you. I promise I will not hurt you. We have all seen the kind of striking that Jesus was referring to, the backhanded slap across the face. That would have been what he was talking about. To initiate an action with the left hand was unlucky, even unclean, so an act with the right hand and a slap across the cheek is not about violence, it's about humiliation. It is about saying, I am in a superior position to you. I am the master, you are the slave. I am the occupier, you are the occupied. I'm the grown-up, you are the child that doesn't know any better. When counseled to turn the other cheek, I can't quite get a good hit, can I? So what I have to do is decide, well, am I going to do something that is unlucky or unclean and do a left-handed strike? Or am I going to slap them with the open hand, which means I'm slapping an equal? I can't do this, but I can do this. But what I have to do is I have to stop and think, what the heck am I going to do? They have just interrupted the cycle that I'm familiar with. Thank you. It says, I am not going to meet your violence with violence, but I will no longer be humiliated by you. You need to look me in the face. It breaks that silence based upon dehumanizing and degrading another person. Second one, sue for your coat. Give them your cloak as well. This wasn't just about a hoodie or an overcoat as we understand it. The typical garb was two garments. There's the outer coat or the robe. The so-called cloak was the undergarment. You had the coat and the cloak underneath. So when someone was securing a loan, it was always better to get a loan to be secured with land. But one could also use their other possessions. And particularly for the working poor who didn't have land, they would often have to secure loans with their clothing, with their coat. There were few in Jesus' audience that would have had loans based on land, but many who would have loans on their coats. And the lawsuit, remember it is, sues you for your coat. The lawsuit described as someone richer suing a poorer person who had defaulted on their debt, someone being sued for everything they owned except their underwear. That would be a dynamic translation. If someone sues you for everything but your underwear, If someone is taking everything, including the shirt, off your back, the poor person has very little left. What Jesus says is, show everyone how unjust this is. Take off your cloak and stand naked in court. That isn't an act of generosity. That is an assertive, non-violent demonstration, street theater, if you will, that unmasks the evil of a system where the rich get richer and the poor get poorer and lose the very little they have. Now, lest we think that this example of Jesus is absurd and unworkable in our world, only about 12 years ago, about 2002, there were hundreds of Nigerian women, mothers, grandmothers, they aged from 20 to 90. They were protesting the oil companies that had taken control of their local Nigerian communities. So these women overran the largest oil-producing facility in Nigeria's southwestern delta. And these unarmed women held 700 oil workers hostage for more than a week. Go, girls, go. And they blocked the production of 500,000 barrels of oil a day. Now, after a week, armed forces were called in and instructed to advance against these unarmed women. They had no defense. So what they did, they stripped naked in front of the armed forces. Now, that may titillate us for a moment, but in the ancient Near East, and still in many cultures, including many African cultures, full nudity in public is a taboo. It doesn't bring shame, especially on the nude person. It is a taboo to gaze upon the nakedness of another. We've got a story about that in the Bible. Remember Noah? Read it. It is a greater shame to look upon a naked person, particularly upon a mother or grandmother's nakedness. They had nothing left but the power of their body on the line, but no violence. It makes me think of the 80s and 90s in the U.S. when HIV and AIDS was still not even being spoken aloud by the powers that be at that time, the powers that were in power in our nation. All people had was their bodies to take to the streets. ACT UP, Queer Nation. They put their very bodies on the line, and things changed. Turn the other cheek. Give your cloak as well as your coat. Go the second mile. There was actually a Roman military practice called angareia, that any citizen of a country that was occupied by the Roman Empire could be forced into service by one of the Roman soldiers. There's actually a biblical example of that. You'll recall during the crucifixion, Simon of Cyrene is enlisted to help carry the cross of Jesus. That was angareia in action. One could be forced to carry the soldier's load or the load of another, but the limits on that practice were very strictly enforced to you could force them to do it for only 1 mile. Because, let's face it, that had been widely abused. So to counsel people to go a second mile, if someone chose to go beyond that forced mile, the soldier, knowing that this extra mile was, if anyone saw this person carrying their load for another mile, the consequences would fall upon them and not upon the person carrying. The person forced into anagoria, often an adult male, in the presence of his family, in an honor and shame culture, being shamed again, that person, by going beyond that second mile, was taking back the power, the little power that they had, the agency that they had in a moment when it was being taken away from them. They took it back. I can do this for a mile, but you can't tell me not to do it for a second mile. Jesus admonished not just some hopeful or passive ideal, It was practical. It was workable in his world, in his culture. It was a tool about how someone who felt, who was less powerful in the face of a crushing situation, that for a time may not be changed, but they can recover their dignity and worth, the power they will always possess. That is an interruption that can change the world. You know, Jesus preached that the realm of God was being ushered in here and now. Proclaims that already you take hold of the truth that you are a person of sacred dignity and worth. You are salt. You are light. You have choices, powerful choices, not to meet hate with hate, not to meet violence with violence, choices that will not leave everyone blind and toothless, choices that don't demean you, choices that don't demonize the other. You don't need to wait until Rome is defeated, until every slave is free, to act that way already. It makes me wonder if that's what it means to love your enemies and to pray for those who curse you. And I'm not talking the prayer where you're carrying someone's load and calling down fire and brimstone upon their head. That's not an unfamiliar prayer, I imagine. That doesn't quite sound like praying for one's enemies. Do we love them enough to believe that they can change for the better? Or have we given up on them? God makes the sun to rise on both the good and the bad, rain upon the righteous and the unrighteous. That kind of generosity and equanimity feels so unnatural for us, but apparently it is natural for God. And as children of God, made in the image of God, is that the kind of generosity of spirit? A hope that not only we can grow and change, but those who might even hurt and oppress can grow and change. Is that not a seed planted, waiting to be awakened? Jesus preached to this marginal crowd of riffraff in ancient Palestine. First, he called them unexpectedly blessed and the ones most ready for what God was about to do. He then pointed them out as spiritual exemplars, the salt of the earth, the light of the world, and challenges them to a soul-searching, demanding moral standard with choices that they had, even in the hardest of circumstances, sacred choices to transform their hard lives. Jesus is not just offering lovely, comforting words to coddle. These are words that 2,000 years ago and today issue a challenge to growth, to wholeness, to maturity, a message that then and now alters expectations of everyone who dares to hear it and take it seriously. It's a message that changed the world. Can it change us? Can it still change our world?